It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of this show is the Babylon Podcast.
Welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Ho, 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 it's Santa Kosh calling from Studio City, California. Ho,
ho, ho, ho, ho. I was wondering when
that
was going to pop
been
out.
Good little podcasters. No, I just figured, you know, all this month, kids, that's what you're getting from me, okay?
We're getting Santa Kosh.
Santa Kosh is coming to town. Okay, so listen, it's about 30 damn degrees here tonight, and the wind is howling somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 miles an hour. So that's almost Mach 1 right now. it is so seasonably unseasonable here that I'm thinking, as Mike suggested, I call my congressman because I just pay too much in taxes to put up with this sort of crap. This is just unacceptable.
But Jeffrey, you just might get your snow.
I can actually, from where I'm sitting right now, there's a. I can see this house that has those cute little, you know, those Christmas, like a deer, you know, and they kind of mechanically move around, you know. Right. Well, the one deer, as he tries to turn his head into the wind, it can barely make it. But then when he goes to turn back, it like, I think he's going to snap his neck. I really do. The wind catches him, whoosh, his antlers are flapping. It's really ugly.
Beavis, get the kite.
Well, that's just that's the weather update for you. I always like to share that kind of information.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that.
It's probably 80 and beautiful there in Richmond, huh?
No, it's not. It's sitting at about mid-50s and kind of overcast.
Yeah, it was about...
It's going to turn into a lovely, dank Richmond winter.
I think it barely got up to 50 here, and the wind was literally whipping like a banshee.
It's always a competition with you two, isn't it?
It is. It is. Because see, now we get to actually go. It's 70 here, and you know, Tim will be going. There's 4 feet of snow outside. I'm going to kill you.
No. It's, with Richmond, what it is, it's 3 inches of rain. If it would snow,
you know,
it'd be marvelous. But what happens is it's still humid, like it is in the summertime, except it's cold.
This could be the foundation for a whole new podcast that could just be like the Babylon Forecast or something like that.
But
no, because Babylon Forecast disappeared, you know, a few years ago. We have to do the Babylon 5 cast.
Thank
dude.
You. He'll be here all night. Very nice, very nice. Try the fish, yes.
But I have something for Jeffrey. I have a present for Jeff from the chat room in response to his Santa Kosh routine.
Oh, no.
And I really was wondering how long it would take before we started doing Santa Kosh, but Grandma got run over by a Vorlon.
Walking back to my level Christmas Eve.
Walking back to Gray 17 on Christmas Eve.
Who's the guy that was doing the music? I want that.
Oh, Stephen Nelson. Yeah, there we go. He needs to do that one.
I want that from him by next week.
Yeah.
Get on it.
Right.
I run over by a four line. That's cool.
Thank you, Bob, really.
That's nice. That's very nice. Thank you very much, chat room.
I'm going to have that lyric in my head driving home now. Okay, we have a metric buttload of voicemails to get to, so we will jump right back into those right after this.
Grasshopper, you have learned much in your training. However, to achieve ultimate geekness, you must pass one final test. You must snatch this chip from my hand, Grasshopper. I wasn't looking. You must snatch this chip from my hand. Once again, you must snatch this chip from my hand. You must snatch this chip. Enough!
Learn to be a true master. Visit geekfuactiongrip.com.
They ask what you want. What lurks in the hearts of men? Only shadows know.
Wow. That was profound, amusing. I like the music. That was good. Who was that?
Christopher Frankie. That is out of the track called Zaha Doom on the volume 2 of the soundtrack from Babylon 5, Messages from Earth.
I meant who did the haiku.
Oh, who did the haiku? Well, of course, I read it. But the haiku itself, the actual real content that matters, that was submitted by Hillary Giffen. And she has done a number of these, and they are all fantastic. And you will be hearing those in subsequent Babylon podcasts because they make great rejoinders. And rather than dump them all on everybody's lap right now, I think we're going to want to draw it out, and people will start anticipating these. So listen for those in upcoming podcasts, people. They're really great. What? They are.
I know they're great.
it's such a pleasure working with you guys. That's all. It's just on my reasonable expectations. So. It was Christopher Franke.
I'm sorry. We're getting a whole lot of Christmas related B5 submissions from the chat room, and we are going to break out Troy Rutter's Drowsy Christmas later when it's closer to Christmas time. But these our fans are brilliant. I love this. Anyway, we have what is that?
Well, here's another one. Before you get going on to that one, here's another brilliant thing that a fan said. This is from our friend Cameron McDonald. In fact.
Oh, cool.
Okay. Are you ready? I'm going to get, what's that?
Your friend, Cameron, from Australia.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Now, Cam says that he did not write this himself, but he found it. So I will submit it for your approval, and this is sort of edited down for time. Paramount Video to release brand new Deep Space Nine, made for video in 2007. Deep Space Nine, the unseen stories to begin production. Paramount Home Video and Paramount Television have announced the start of production of Deep Space Nine, The Unseen Stories, a made-for-video movie that will be targeted toward the Star Trek loyal audience and science fiction fans in general. This made-for-DVD release will include two new Deep Space Nine stories collectively entitled Listening in the Shadows, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes content. Deep Space Nine was the most unique and original contribution to the Star Trek universe ever, which is in no way inspired by or connected to the creation or release of anything else. No matter how similar appearances may be, how suspicious the timing is, or how much physical or anecdotal evidence exists to the contrary. Release date is to be announced, but is promised to come before the release of any other similar release by another company.
Wow, I missed that one in the trades.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right, there you are. All right, Summer, proceed with your regularly scheduled program.
Can I read some of the Christmas lines coming out of the chat room? Okay, we have.
Please do.
Shadows
yes.
roasting over an open fire.
yes.
Kosti the snowman.
Okay.
I saw Lita kissing Santa Kosh. Is that great or what?
That's awesome. That one's a big one.
We have to do full lyrics for that one. I'm trying to remember the lyrics. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Kosh had an encounter suit that glowed. anyway, I love our fans. I really do.
We have the best.
We do. We have, what is it, 12? 11? We have 11 voicemails this week. Wow. All right, let's get them started.
Yep.
Hi, this is Iron Eagle again with some comments on Show 42. Geometry of Shadows is one of the funniest B5 episodes ever, but you missed Veer completely. For example, his famous line, "I work for Ambassador Molari," after a while, nothing bothers you. He's just great. Your comments on the Technomages returning in Crusade made me finally buy the DVD sets. Let's see what awaits me there. And finally, to Jasto, purple.
Yes. Well, Iron Eagle, you've hopefully by now have gotten into watching Crusade, and like all of us, you will be heartbroken at the potential that was there and never realized.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know. I don't know. What were the Technomage novelizations ever published over in various countries in Europe?
I have no idea.
No idea. We should find that out.
But this being the global marketplace that it is, I'm sure that people could get a hold of copies in some form or another. Where there's a will, there's a way. You know?
Yes. eBay is truly global now. All hail eBay. Okay.
Right.
Next message.
This is Jason in Kansas City. Just got done listening to show number 41. And after your musical interlude, you're talking about the possibility of doing different songs, different theme songs for different characters. I think you missed the boat with Kosh. Shaft is the obvious choice for theme music for this wonderful character. Now, I don't have much of a musical voice, so I'm not going to attempt to sing it and hurt everybody's ears, but I'm sure somebody out there in the audience can pull this one off a lot better than I could.
Shut your mouth!
He's one bad...
talking about Kosh.
He's one bad mother. Shut your mouth. Just talking about Kosh. There you go.
Oh, I
Here's
like
the dude
that.
With a shower curtain that all the chicks are.
Oh, yeah. I see one that one coming. Flirting. Okay.
Yeah, we can run quite far with that one. That's to say, we have to get all the Kosh lyrics up and then see if we can get either George Rabb or Jonathan Colton to actually do the song.
And hey, you know what? There's our contest. Mike, you wanted to get rid of some of those MST3K videos?
No, I got rid of them already.
You did?
Oh, never mind.
Oh, bummer.
Okay. Too bad, because I was going to say, maybe that's the contest, to have somebody work up the best set of lyrics and...
Hey, we got other stuff to give away here. Don't give up on that.
All right, well, we'll talk about that amongst ourselves at some point, but I submit that for your approval.
Okay. We have a metric buttload of books laying around here, too, that we could probably start throwing out. So.
We'll have to work on
all
that.
All right.
Then. Hi, Mark from Lowell, listening to podcast number 34, and I haven't caught up yet. I just started like a month ago, and found this podcast, and I am extremely excited about it, and that's great, and I've made some donations to PayPal for it, and they were discussing the Grey Council knowing whether Valen's soul, and the new Grey Council members were told about it, as Nerun was told when he became a Grey Council member, and got very tweaked about that. This is great. I love it. Thanks for all this stuff, and I'll keep listening.
Awesome. What was his name, Mark?
Mark. Mm-hmm.
Mark, yeah, I think that's commendable. If he's been just found us a month ago and he's already 34 episodes into it, that means he's pretty much doing a show a day, which is more than I could possibly.
Well, you know, it
pretty much flattens me, but...
Me too. You know, it's interesting because we get, I wouldn't say a lot, but we get regular email from listeners who have just found the podcast and are frantically catching up with us. So it's good to know that our audience is growing.
Yeah.
And that they're frantic.
And he donated money, which is really important.
Cool.
Even better.
Mark,
thank
he's
you.
At
Mark,
the top
you are
of the Christmas list right now.
Yeah.
That's right.
Of course, I stole it. Now I only need $5,980 to get my new mixer board. So.
Wait, Well, but Mike, if you're really good and you leave milk and cookies out, Santa Kosh just might bring what you're asking.
There you go.
And since that board
is... You have to make, sorry, go ahead.
Said, since that board will go to making the Babylon podcast sound even better, I think Mark will understand.
Mm. Yes, it will, too. So Summer doesn't keep blowing her channel out anymore.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's a quick comment about Babylon 5 episode of... Oh, God. Let me try that again. The Babylon 5 podcast, episode 43. Tim was complaining about techno mazes and how really that looked like it was going to be a fantasy-type thing. I agree with him completely. Until they did a couple of things that were truly cool. Like Summer, I'm a Unix engineer, and all the Unix engineers I know, we all refer to ourselves as low-level techno mages, because what we do is bloody magic, and it's nothing to everybody else, but it's nothing more than just technology, knowing how it works, using it to its ability, and that's why we love the techno mage. They're all basically the same in that regard. Yeah, they started to push it a little bit into the fantasy shit, but that it went too far. It almost went too far, but it did. So I just thought I would share that. Okay, talk to you guys later. Bye.
Interesting. I thought a lot of people reacted positively to the introduction of the techno mages. I had no idea that there were people.
That there's two of us out there.
That they were fans who went, "What is this crap?" No idea.
Well, yeah. See, and as I might have said before, the first introduction of the techno mages was a lot of, you know, here there be monsters kind of thing, and to me that just doesn't fly. Now when Galen is what made it work for me. Things like Well of Forever, when he's monitoring communications on board the Excalibur, and he summons up that little ball that's floating there, and it's a readout. That, to me, that's cool. That's techno-mage stuff. Some of the stuff you would do to disappear and come in and out, that's cool. That, to me, is techno-mage stuff. But making a giant monster stomp around the corner to scare the pants off Veer, that's bogus to me.
Well, so. Elric did the disappearing thing too, and the little cool, you know, recording playback to prove that Londo was lying. Yeah. That was cool.
Yeah, but then the little gremlins hanging off of Londo's coat. That was dumb.
Hey, I got a remote control that runs my entire TV system. I'm pretty sure that the techno mages put that together.
I'm pretty sure for me, the original techno mage was Batman.
Ooh.
You are right, sir. You are absolutely right.
And if you don't have a utility belt, you just ain't shit.
That's right. But he didn't have a Minbari fighting pole.
Well,
I'm so I'm not touching
touch
that.
One.
I am not touching that.
Exactly.
Hey, Bob, Battle One Podcast. This is Thomas from Flagstaff. I'm just checking in to say you guys are doing a great job, Phil. And I wanted to welcome the new fourth member of your cast, evidently for all the airtime you've been getting lately. So glad to hear you on the Show Yard show, and I hope you'll be the best, fourth member of the team. Thanks. Bye.
So that makes Mike our very own Pete Best.
Welcome to the Babylon Podcast.
This is Jasto from the Netherlands in response to episode 42. First of all, since I seem to have been promoted to your producer, let me give my official producer stamp of approval to Jeffrey for bringing on past guests to talk about updates on projects they'd mentioned, especially when there's much fun to listen to as Stephen first. Secondly, I wasn't actually the one planning to set up a European livestream relay, but after helping Warlord 2K field test his, I figured, what the hell, I'll set one up as well. So now there are two European livestream servers.
Nice.
Unfortunately today, Yarstos wasn't working from our side, but he is refeeding out on Warlord, so we have four servers, hopefully soon to be one server that those four servers can feed off of if we get all of our servers. Never mind, later.
It's also technical.
Would you, could you in a box?
I'd have to stretch first.
Oh, Summer!
Yes, and we instantly go to the Minbari fighting pole.
Oh, she won't touch the pole, but she'll climb into the gutter, won't she?
This is Herstel from the Netherlands with a response to the deep geeking for Geometry of Shadows. First of all, I have to disagree with Tim about the Technomages. There is already a split between those who understand computers and those who don't. Even many competent computer users don't know how anything happens or how things are fixed. What those in the know do to make this work might as well be magic to them. The Technomages are no more than a logical progression from this situation. Secondly, while I was thinking about the episode, I realized that the Drazi political system may actually work. Logically, one would expect the side with the better leadership to win eventually. Of course, leadership in war and leadership in politics aren't necessarily the same thing, but as random as the system is, it actually has a pretty good chance of selecting effective leaders. On the other hand, it can't be perfect, because it still hasn't managed to do away with bureaucracy yet. And for Iron Eagle, green.
Really get nuts.
Yeah, you know what? I get worried when there's going to be fights in the European chat room and there's going to be dead bodies that we're going to have to clean up.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, actually, what was that movie? There was the video, Two Tribes Go to War, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, but there was Robot Jocks. What, didn't Robot Jocks have, like, proxy mecha robots fighting each other instead of the countries going to war?
Yep.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so we can get there.
Wow.
We have the technology. We can rebuild.
I heard a commercial the other day on the radio that Yarstow's comment brings this to mind. It is for a new product. It is basically a thermometer that you just kind of place on somebody's forehead and you're able to nearly instantly get a read on their temperature. Okay? And it is described as working like magic. And I'm sitting there going, you know what? That's the problem. The problem we have is that, as Yarstow says, there are people who don't understand how the technology works, and so it does become magic. Well, the difference in my mind, anyways, and maybe I'm splitting hairs, but with technology, the thing is, it with a little bit of effort, people can understand it. I mean, you don't necessarily have to be able to understand exactly how a printed circuit board goes together, but you, if you recognize the fact that this is based on, you know, laws of physics, then it becomes understandable. And that's what concerns me, is when the technology is painted as magic in the society, then people feel, that's where I think disenfranchisement starts taking place, because then they feel, oh, magic, I don't understand magic, I can't understand this, and it just becomes a mystery. And to me, especially going forward in the future, a technologically based society cannot have members of its society who deal with technology as unintelligible mumble jumbo that only the ordained priesthood can work with.
See, because we all know that it's electric fairies.
Mm-hmm. And just when you said that, the first thing that I thought that came to my mind was, these people are going to put an ad on TV going, got a fever? Apply directly to the forehead. And I was going to have to shoot my TV again.
Again?
Again.
Yeah, dude.
Tim, I wish you could have that conversation, that argument with that debate, if you will, with Alexander Graham Bell. I would have loved to have heard how he might have responded to you.
Hmm.
Jingle bells, Morden smells, Bester laid an egg. Thank you, James. Next voicemail. Nice.
We can always count on our fans to deflate any sort of pretense that we might be drifting towards. Thank you for that.
Hi, Tim, Summer, and Jeffrey. This is Edmund from Greenville. Long time, long-winded emailer. First time caller. Hoping to break the Yarstow voicemail filibuster. Had a comment on the Boys Night Out show. One point, Jeffrey was stepping all over his cues and Mike was wondering whether he should put down some tape on the floor, the way they do in the soundstage. As he said that, it occurred to me that since this is an audio program, perhaps it would be better to put the tape on Jeffrey's mouth, where it could then, of course, be removed with a suitably satisfying ripping sound at the appropriate moment. Anyway, just a thought, and observing the new Babylon 5 communication protocol and anticipating the reaction to my comment, I will sign off. Love you. Mean it. Bye.
Don't well, think so.
First of all, that sign-off firmly plants Edmund in the side of the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, though, he's not such a bad guy if somebody's finally picking on someone other than me. So keep sending him, Edmund.
So that's what happens when I'm not here, huh?
No, it went very smoothly, Summer. Don't worry about it.
I know. I heard. I listened.
Yeah, did you cringe ever?
I was giggling, actually, because I was packing for Austin while listening in. Just, you guys cracked me up.
That was a fun show. We did pretty well.
Hi, Tim and Summer, CA Sizemore in Phoenix, Arizona. I think you guys are doing an excellent job. I enjoyed the hell out of Peter Jurassic's interview, and I'm looking forward to more interviews like that. Oh, and by the way, you guys rock. And have a good one. Oh, purple beat green. Later. Bye.
Hi. Thank you, CA, I think. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. CA is right under Mark as our favorite fans right now.
Yeah, exactly. There's definitely, we're getting the green and purple separation in the fans, not only from their own declaration, but those who want to put accolades above us and those who just want to put tape on our mouths.
And you know what I just noticed? Mm. One of our cats has a purple collar.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I think my
You're
roommate's...
special.
Does the dog have a green one?
We don't have dogs. So that tells you how that fight ended.
Oh. I just had a mental picture of a dog being a kitty snack.
Okay, and to wrap things up, I have an email here. This is also from Edmund Boys. Hi, Tim, Summer, and Jeffrey. After your Geometry of Shadows discussion, I had a thought on the Drazi conflict. It's implied that the Greens up the ante into lethal conflict. That's a new development. Could this be an early indication of shadow influence sowing chaos behind the scenes? I'd always focused on the humorous side of that subplot, but your comment about the Technomage's exodus being driven by signs of shadow influence got me thinking. Knowing how carefully JMS constructs his stories, it makes sense that hidden shadow influence in one story would be mirrored in the other. Also, the title gives a clue. The shadows don't appear in the episode, but we're shown the effects of their presence via Londo and Rifa, the Technomages, and, I submit for your approval, the Drazi as well. The shadows have entered the equation, and we are seeing the deflections and triangulations that result. Perhaps a better analogy is pebbles thrown into a pond. JMS doesn't show us the stone's impact, just the ripples around us.
Hmm.
On a lighter note, I've always loved the performance of the Green Drazi leader. All the actors who had to don the prosthetics talk about the difficulty of acting and expressing emotion through the latex. He really does a wonderful and very funny job, right up there in the pantheon of prosthetics with Andreas and Wayne Alexander.
Hmm.
You know, it's interesting because when we were talking, when we were doing the deep geeking on Geometry of Shadows, that thought that Edmund brings up tickled around the edge of my brain regarding the meaning of the title, but I couldn't articulate it. And Edmund really does a good job of making that clear and bringing that out into the light, as it were. So
good
insights on his part.
I would submit that the answer is no, but could the shadows have timed their return to coincide with existing or known to be pre-existing chaos so they could hover around a bit more without being noticed? Because we say, you know, every 5 years, the Drazi have this competition, this you know, fight for supremacy in their government.
Right.
So how can that be a shadow plot if this is part of the Drazi culture going back thousands of years?
What he's saying is that the upping the ante by starting to kill each other was new.
I would submit that that would be the influence of being around more aliens. Because humans are, we are a fractious lot.
You could say that, yes.
And we've seen in other episodes how other alien cultures are saying how they feel like their culture has been co-opted by human culture, and then later humans thinking that their culture has been co-opted by aliens plays a really big part later.
Right.
So could be a little cross-pollination there.
Living in the shadow of shadows.
That too.
I tend to think that I'm not sure that the shadows necessarily timed their reappearance with something like the Drazi political process, shall we say, but I think it's one of those things that they certainly would take advantage of because you know, you're already dealing with a chaotic situation, and it could just be one of those things again. How you know, one of the issues you deal with at any period of time is what's the real threat and what is just noise, and I think that you know that's kind of what JMS does with the overall arc is he gives us these incidents which are you know a lot of sound and fury, but in the end signify nothing, but our characters are paying attention to this, so they're not able to focus on what eventually becomes a real threat until much later. So, anyways, there you are. I think we're done, yes?
Yes, we are done.
Did we clear out that giant stack of stuff?
We cleared out that stack, and Mike is giving me the wrap it up, hurry up, get out of here.
Got it.
So we will take a short break and come back with some deep geeking.
This is Bob. Before, Bob relied on the internet to enhance his geek status. After using Technorama for natural geek enhancement, Bob is rolling his 20-sided die, reciting Holy Grail lines, and answering Star Trek trivia with the best of them. And he has a happy missus at the home, too. Technorama for natural geek enhancement. Only available at chuckchat.com.
Digging down to the obscurest facts in fandom, this is Deep Geeking.
All right. Thank you. I like that. That is... that tickles me. I don't know why.
That's good. I've got one. Oddly appropriate.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, here you go. Tim and Summer sitting in a tree.
Oh,
D-E-E-K-G-E-E-K-G-E-E-K-I-N-G.
Spell much?
I got work on it. That's just the opening, okay?
Oh, everybody around here is drinking but me.
Oh my.
Alcohol makes podcasting fun.
Yeah. Makes podcasting.
Well, alcohol was involved with getting podcast going, right? Somewhere along the line?
Okay. I do believe it is the backbone of the entire industry.
Whatever it takes.
It's fair to say that alcohol is responsible for podcasting and pregnancy.
That's on the Surgeon General's warning label there, isn't it?
That's actually what I was worried about, Mike.
To pregnancy and podcasting.
Oh, my goodness.
When Tim told us about this new gizmo that you stick on your forehead to see what the temperature was, I could see variations on that technology where a cop could just pull you over and slap that on your forehead and go, oh, drunk.
Hey, you know what I heard is there is... I can't remember the company, but they are working on a mobile phone which incorporates a breathalyzer. you breathe into a little sensor on the side of the phone, and it pops up your blood alcohol content. And if you're too drunk to drive, the little video screen on the phone displays a car weaving all over the road. I kid you not.
You get ticketed for drunk dialing.
Wow.
That's gonna become a drinking game better in quarters, man.
I tell you what. That's great. Doesn't sound like a deterrent to drinking to me. Let's make the car weave. What happens if you get really drunk and crashes? I'm to level 3.
That's just anyway. Into our deep geeking today, we hit another. Well, I don't know what you call this—a second season episode, A Distant Star, featuring Rust Hamlin as a friend, an old friend of Captain Sheridan, who's stopping by the station on a supply run, and all sorts of chaos ensues. How's that for a summation?
That's pretty much it right there. Well, Jeffrey, here's my question for you. This is what I wanted to know. Jack Maynard, who is captain of the Cortez, the Explorer ship, and an old friend, and as we find out, a commanding officer of a young John Sheridan, was played by Rust Hamlin. Now, Mr. Hamlin, of course, was previously seen on Twin Peaks, but as an actor of some repute even before that. So my question to you, Jeffrey, is when you have an actor of that stature, and there were a number of others who also had guest shots on Babylon 5, how is it working with someone like that, and what is it like on the set?
Oh, you know what? Most all of those guys are so pro. Rust Hamlin was such a sweetheart, just a genuine nice guy, and just so professional and so friendly and genuinely happy to be there. I think he was really getting a kick out of it. So, most all times it's just a really, really delightful experience. There are a few that I won't name. There were a few that I don't think came to, that showed up with the right attitude, just sort of, I guess, looked down at it or didn't care or whatever and didn't seem to be quite as prepared as they would be and as they should have been. And that was a bit disappointing because you get all excited about meeting somebody and then, you know, you're just, you know, a couple hours into the day, you're just going, oh, brother, why did we bring this guy here? But that aside, most all of them have just been, you know, it was always a real hoot. And it was a lot of fun for us, too, just because, you know, you can only look at Claudia and Bruce so much, and it was really kind of nice to have somebody else show up.
Well,
especially like when you have Michael York, you know, I mean, people of that kind of stature, and then like, yeah, Rust Hamlin, and some of them, it was a hoot. Just great. Really great.
I can't wait till we get to talk about Majel Barrett, but we'll save that for another time.
Mm-hmm.
So given that Rust Hamlin was a fun guy to work with, I think that you do see good chemistry between he and Bruce Boxleitner as their characters are interacting.
Yeah, they definitely... it's my recollection that Bruce was especially tickled that Russ was on the show. I don't know for a fact if they had ever worked together before, but Bruce was very excited about having Russ there, and they did get along quite well, and I think that comes across on screen too.
I remember the when I first saw this episode and was watching the credits roll by, I was trying to figure out where I'd heard the voice before, and it didn't dawn on me. I'm like, where do I know that voice from? Where do I know that voice from? And then the credits roll after it comes back from commercial, and I see that, you know, the name is Rust Hamlin, and I went, whoa, because I had literally just that very week watched West Side Story. And in the film version of West Side Story and in the film version of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, he's performing in there. He is Riff in West Side Story, and he's the youngest brother in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. And I was just like, no way. How'd they get him on here?
Because Babylon 5 is a very special place.
That is. So I was that just kind of like, whoa, cool. So I don't know.
Okay, now we can play 6 degrees of whatever, because William Shatner was also in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, if I recall correctly. And D.C. Fontana, who was a writer for the original Star Trek, wrote this particular episode for Babylon 5.
Yes, she did.
So
we have all sorts of links going on here.
Now, having said that, in my mind, while there's some neat character stuff going on here, this is really a, for lack of a better term, a setup episode. And the setup, of course, is the appearance of the shadow vessel in hyperspace.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, there's not really a lot going on in this particular episode. Nothing earth-shattering, shall we say, or station-rending, even. The main plot, which, of course, is the Cortez showing up and then getting lost in hyperspace, is sort of that techno-babble thing that never quite suits Babylon 5 too well. And what makes this episode work are the little things, like we've, you know, as Jeffrey mentioned, the chemistry between Bruce Boxleitner and Russ Tamblyn, their characters. There's a brief scene with Delenn talking with him in Bari, and you're starting to get a sense of the stress and conflict that is building within that society and the reaction to Delenn's transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you know, a little bit of character development with Captain Sheridan and his reaction with being assigned to Babylon 5. You see how he kind of gets a little pissy, if you will, after Maynard shows up and says, oh, yeah, I never thought I'd see you chained to a desk.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes him call into question, you know, what he's doing. So, your thoughts, Summer?
My thoughts are, I don't know, a lot of the dialogue that Sheridan seemed to have and some of the dialogue that Maynard had were just seemed forced at times. It didn't seem like they were naturally saying it. It's like they were rushing through it. It felt a little off, and I don't know why. I really can't put my finger on why. And it confounds me, because DC Fontana also wrote Legacies and The War Prayer, and those seem to flow a lot better in terms of dialogue between many people, and this one didn't.
Right, I agree with you. I think especially the scenes on the Cortez with Maynard and his crew, there was just something, I'm not quite natural in how they were interacting. You know, it seemed almost very much like we are now doing the scene on the starship kind of thing. And yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, the usually dependable DC Fontana just didn't quite pull this one off, or, you know, maybe, like I said, I think the main reason for the existence of this episode was simply to establish another presence for the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And even that seemed kind of awkward. You know, I mean, for a threat that's been lurking in the shadows, if you will, for it to show up on top of a group of ships, not once but twice, and cause damage but not do the kind of destruction that we've seen them do, there's something's not right with that.
That part I didn't have a problem with, and I'll tell
really?
You why. Yes, we had already seen the shadow ships come in and out of hyperspace wherever they want.
right,
you know, off the beaten mm-hmm. path, so to speak. These Star Furies were positioned off the beaten path, trying to find out where this lost ship had drifted to. I can take that. Also, you imagine yourself on a clear, bright, warm summer day. You're in a pool doing a breaststroke, backstroke, whatever your favorite swimming maneuver is.
Whatever and your favorite stroke is.
I wasn't going to say that.
And yes, you were.
Yeah,
but
I was not. I was not. I mentally censored that. And your hand comes down and happens to bash a bug that just happened to land on the water. Do you notice it and go back and kill it, or do you just not care? This was like a fly bouncing off the hull, bouncing off your windshield.
So yeah, but you know what? But I see where you're going with that analogy, but the fact that it comes back again, that's like saying, you know what? I just smacked a bug with my windshield. I'm going to back the car up and try to fly into the bug again.
I also...
I can deal with... I hear what you're saying, and yes, I can accept the fact that the Star Furies are not where they normally would be, and we'll get to that in a minute. And so, the Shadow Vessel accidentally comes across them. But number one, given the fact that we see subsequently that they pretty much wipe out anybody they run into until they're ready to reveal themselves, this vessel leaves two ships who are apparently helpless in hyperspace, leaves them behind instead of wiping them out and going on its merry way, okay? And then it comes back again. You know, even if you smack the bug on the windshield, let's take that analogy. You might stop and look at what's on the bug on the windshield before you go on, but you're not going to sit there and keep smashing into it.
Okay. In terms,
right. And that's my thing. That's what really bothers me about that. It's you know, I mean, you know, if the ship, you know, if the Shadow Vessel had found them and then kind of hovered off in the distance, I could take that. And then you've got Keffer doing the little, you know, loop de loop, you know, firing his weapons back the direction to come and keeps getting glimpses of it, but never can quite lock onto it because he's, you know, swinging around all the time, and then the thing disappears. You know, anyways, so that's, I hear what you're saying, I still disagree. Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt because the first ship was destroyed, and we've heard previously that scanners aren't very accurate in hyperspace, whether or not that applies to the first ones or not, we don't know, we may never know.
Right.
But I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. They hit something, oh look, it blew up, bye. And they're just traveling between their own, you know, network of gates the way everybody else travels between the main network of gates. I don't know.
Right. Well, and they don't use gates, we know that. They just ripple in and out of hyperspace.
Right, but they do still have, you know, the hyperspace equivalent of shipping lanes.
Okay, sure. I mean, I'll give you that. We never know enough about Shadow Society to know how organized it is in terms of that. But that's fine. I'll grant you that.
Yeah,
but see, that leads to the bigger issue. I shouldn't say bigger issue, but another thing that gets me thinking and where this starts falling apart again in terms of technobabble. If the Shadow, as Keffer says afterwards, he figured this vessel had come and was riding its own beacon. Mm-hmm. Okay. How would that even help him finding the proper gate back to Babylon 5?
I actually translated that technobabble. It wasn't well said, but I understand what he was saying. He calculated the angle of the first encounter back to their angle, to their gate, and he calculated the angle of the second encounter and was able to extrapolate where his gate should have been. That's what my brain said, he said, and I'm sticking to it.
Oh, okay, if you will, but that's...
how he was able to do that math, I don't know.
I see.
But that's what he said he did.
Yeah, but see, to me, that's really what he's saying is he's extremely, supremely lucky to have guessed right, because
he
has to make two really gigantic assumptions. Number one, first of all, if his navigation system's offline, right?
Yes.
Okay. He has to assume that the shadow, the strange ship that comes in the first time and back again, is first of all going in the same, on the same vector. Okay? And given that, you know, hyperspace is this weird place, you're never quite sure what's going on, and you need a lock-on beacon, even explorers who are out exploring on the rim need at least that one anchor point from which to make their calculations. Okay? He is basically making the assumption that this is the same ship, or at least two ships on the same shipping lane. And then from there, he's assuming that that his vector, whatever direction he's on, is still the same vector he was moving away from Babylon 5.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So at that point, I don't care how good his calculation is. I don't care how accurate his computer might be. He's working off of two gigantic assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you know, again, maybe, well, you know, there's always the argument when you're dealing with this kind of thing that you're dealing with heroes, and so they are able to do those things, even if it's just that they're lucky. I'll grant you that.
Yeah.
But that's where the whole thing about hyperspace and the whole technobabble starts coming in. It's like, you know, it works this way because we just decide it's going to work this way.
I guess my biggest problem with this episode is that the entire setup, everything about that episode was just to have Keffer see a shadow vessel and have a reason to obsessively pursue them to try and figure out what they are and why they're there.
Right.
And it's not a strong... Okay, ready?
Yep.
A strong story. It's just, it's not... It doesn't work. It takes away from that domino being set up. And following Geometry of Shadows, it's cringeworthy almost.
Right. I agree with you. I think it might have been stronger had you've got something else going on in hyperspace. It doesn't even have to be the drama of the lost ship, but just something where Keffer keeps seeing this strange vessel off the edges and the fringes of hyperspace, and that could set him off. And as we find out in future episodes, other people have been seeing this thing out in hyperspace.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't necessarily need to have the life-threatening incident to kick off his curiosity. So, yeah, I agree with you on that. Almost melodramatic, if you will.
A little bit too melodramatic, yeah.
Now, on the flip side, we have a very humorous B story, which I liked quite a bit, and this has to do with the diets that the command staff are put on. Excuse me, the food plans.
Food plan.
That the command staff has put on. And, of course, Garibaldi trying to get the ingredients for his bagna cotta. Which, by the way, on the Lurker's Guide, there is a recipe for that.
Is it a real dish?
It is a real dish, and on the Lurker's Guide, it even cites the Frugal Gourmet, I believe, is where the recipe comes from. And I have to say that except for the anchovies, which I had a bad experience with one time, so I don't ever want to have them again, the rest of it looks awesome. I mean, a stick of butter melted in olive oil, oh my God, that's fantastic.
I've been listening to a lot of... Paula Deen on the Food Network. She's my roommate's favorite cook, and just hearing her, he's like, "You put in a half a pound of butter." I'm like, "What?" Yeah. Everything is a half a pound of butter. I'm like, "Oh my god!"
I love the scene where they're sitting in the Zocalo, Sheridan and Garibaldi and Ivanova, and they're looking at their various dishes that they have, and of course, each one has got something the other likes, and as they're looking at it, I love the bit where all of a sudden Sheridan turns and points his fork and says, "It's all his fault." Garibaldi's like, "What?" And they switch the dishes just in time for Dr. Franklin to come around.
Right,
that was
classic. That was beautifully done. Beautifully done.
Right. and that's where the writing is very spry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scenes where they're in med lab and getting their the food plans, and their little reactions. Garibaldi looks over his, and as he's going out, he casually sets his on Franklin's desk with every intention of just leaving it there, and the good doctor says, Mr. Garibaldi, you forgot your food plan.
Mm-hmm.
And Ivanova looking at hers, and oh, she says, I'll gain weight. and her comment about the expanding Russian frontier.
Yeah.
But with very,
very
nice borders. I loved that. That was great. That was fantastic.
That was beautiful. That was, those little bits being so strong and so funny just make the other bits where, you know, Sheridan has a meltdown because he's got a desk job now and he's not sure he wants it because he sees his friend come back who's off exploring the deep ranges of space, which is what he always wanted to do. And it just makes that, the contrast is very, very, very disjointed.
It's almost like it was written by two different people.
Kind of feels like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. I wonder if there were any rewrites done.
It's hard to say, especially given that it contains a major plot thread, what with Kefir and the Shadow Vessel. So one has to think that at some point, certainly JMS had to sit down and say, okay, look, whatever you write, you got to put this part into it. And, you know, given the story in the War Prayer regarding the two young Centauri lovers and JMS saying, I don't want it in there, and DC Fontana supposedly saying, no, you want this in here. I wonder if a similar thing might have happened. I'm not suggesting there was a spat or a row or anything like that, but I just wonder, you know, if the story, if as Fontana wrote it, was going in one direction and JMS said, no, you've got to have this in here, and it just never quite gelled.
Hmm. Interesting. Wonder if we'll ever find that out.
Yep. I don't know. It's not in volume 3 of the B5 script books because it was not a script written by JMS.
Right. Far as I can tell, I don't think DC Fontana did any other Babylon 5 stories after that one.
No, that was
the last one.
And really going forward, if memory serves correctly, you start to get more and more scripts by JMS, and the few that are not by him are written by the usual suspects. Peter David, who also, he contributes two this year. But I'm trying to think who else might have written them, but I think really you really start to get a stronger presence from JMS's own word processor. So.
Which leads us to his monumental achievements for seasons 3 and 4.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It is sort of a prelude to that.
Mm-hmm.
And one last thing before we go, I did want to mention that, you know, we start to see the burgeoning relationship between Delenn and Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that makes that whole character story great is that it does start so quiet and so slow. You know, I mean, you can not at this point see, I'm trying to remember, it's actually a few episodes later where she invites Sheridan to dinner that I started thinking, oh, you know what, I bet they're falling in love. But at this point, it's not there, and it's just sort of a mutual respect. But that last scene in the garden where Delenn says the universe knows what it's doing, and we're all where we need to be because that's where we need to be. You know, not only does that tie into what we see later with Come the Inquisitor, you know, the right people in the right place, but also just kind of, you know, the kind of relationship that they will eventually grow into. You know, her comments bring out a more thoughtful side in Sheridan. And you can see him, you know, he can see how his spirits are lifted and his heart is warmed by what she says.
And then the follow-up line by Ivanova commenting on what she said says, aren't we all? That just kind of brought him back to, okay, yeah, this isn't such a big deal.
Right. But yeah, and her comment is very much like, you know, this is the most obvious thing, you know. Aren't we all? Right. Yeah. So.
Did we hit everything?
An okay episode. Yeah, I think pretty much. You know, it's an episode that has some highlights in it and some fun stuff for fans. You know, but also not one of the better offerings either.
Mm-hmm. So. I just think it suffers a great, great deal because it followed Geometry of Shadows.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Are we done?
I think so.
Cool. All right. We'll continue with our deep geeking. Hopefully make this more of a regular occurrence because this is what this show is all about.
Exactly.
If you want to be like Jarstow and make yourself a running staple of the show, you can send us an email at babylonpodcast@gmail.com or send us a voicemail. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
And be sure to check our website for the details on how to listen to us record this live. We will see you next time on the other side of the gate.